This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli forces once again raided the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, killing two Palestinians and injuring nearly a dozen. A car bomb explosion hits the bridge that connects the Crimean Peninsula to the Russian mainland, with a senior local official blaming it on, quote, Ukrainian vandals. Also ahead, Iran says the link between the acts of violence against its diplomatic missions in Europe and the West's support for rioters in the country is undeniable. Our top story this hour: Israeli forces have killed two Palestinians in the occupied West Bank after they attacked the Jenin refugee camp. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 11 others were also injured in the raid. That brings to four the number of Palestinians, including two teenagers, killed by forces over the past 24 hours. Palestinian security sources say undercover Israeli forces sneaked into the Jenin camp. Later, dozens of armored vehicles stormed the camp from multiple directions. Troops also reportedly fired towards journalists covering the raid. The Jenin refugee camp has been the focal point of an Israeli crackdown that has intensified in recent months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks across the occupied territories so far this year. Mona Kandil is our correspondent in occupied Ramallah and joins us now. Mona, what more can you tell us about this latest attack and raid by the Israeli regime forces? It does seem that they are unable to control the resistance from the, especially in Jenin.
Yesterday, the Israeli forces killed two Palestinians in separate incidents in Qalqilia and in Al-Mazra' al-Gharbiya near Ramallah. Today, the Israeli forces raided again the Jenin refugee camp. According to the Israeli military, the operation aimed to arrest a Palestinian accused by the Israeli military for being wanted for security reasons. They surrounded a house in the Jenin refugee camp. Of course, confrontations took place between Palestinian fighters and Palestinian residents of the refugee camp and the Israeli forces. The Israeli troops shot dead two Palestinians and wounded at least 11 others. According to Palestinian paramedics, three of those who were wounded are in serious condition. Now, the Israeli military claimed that the man who they wanted to arrest, or the main aim of this operation was to arrest former Palestinian prisoner Mohammed Abu Zaina, and they claimed that they have arrested Mohammed Abu Zaina during this operation, and they killed two Palestinians and wounded others during Saturday operation to Jenin refugee camp.
Right, and then very quickly, Mona, targeting Palestinian journalists as well, in the aftermath of the Shireen Abu Akleh's murder by an Israeli sniper.
Exactly. During the operation to Jenin refugee camp, we received that at least four Palestinian journalists had been surrounded by the Israeli forces raiding the refugee camp, and they were throwing heavy tear gas and stun grenades directly towards or in the direction of those Palestinian prisoners. It's not the first time in the few days. The same thing happened. Israeli forces had attacked Palestinian journalists, and they even fired, used their fire against them. At least two Palestinians were shot by the Israeli fire. in the last 2 days. And today, those four Palestinians suffered suffocation due to inhaling tear gas. And it was clear that the Israeli soldiers were aiming directly at those Palestinian journalists.
Okay, Mona, thank you very much indeed for that. Mona Kandil, there, our journalist joining us from the occupied Palestinian territories. Turning to the besiege of the Gaza Strip, where a mass rally has been held to mark the 35th anniversary of the establishment of the Islamic Jihad movement, the movement that refuses to recognize the Israeli regime while maintaining armed resistance as the only way to liberate Palestine. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Thousands of Palestinians have rallied in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 35th anniversary of the outset of the Islamic Jihad movement. People from all walks of life joined to show their support. The Islamic Jihad movement is highly respected by all Palestinian factions and has always been a uniting factor among them. The movement was founded by the late Dr. Fathi Shaqaqi, who was inspired by the Iranian Revolution and the teachings of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini.
Today we pay tribute to our founder Fathi Shaqaqi and all the martyrs. Our path is a very long one and paved by the blood of martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of Islam and for the sake of Al-Quds.
Ziyad al-Nakhala, the Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, addressed the attendees via satellite link. During his speech, al-Nakhala stressed the unity among all Palestinian factions and praised the axis of resistance against the Israeli regime.
Gaza is part of the axis of resistance, and this rally stresses that armed resistance is the key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. People attending this event are affirming their allegiance to the resistance and to the Islamic Jihad movement.
The Islamic Jihad movement and its leaders remain blacklisted by the European Union and the United States for refusing to recognize the Israeli regime.
We are all here to support the resistance against the Zionist regime. Our people are sending a strong message to the whole world today about their unwavering support for the resistance. We will continue our struggle until the liberation of Al-Quds.
Islamic Jihad supporters want the Israeli regime to know that their movement is a force to be reckoned with.
35 years on, the popularity of the Islamic Jihad movement continues to grow due to the movement's strict adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Elsewhere, a large fire triggered by a car bomb blast has ripped through a bridge linking the Crimean Peninsula to mainland Russia, prompting reactions from Ukrainian and Russian officials. Moscow say a freight truck exploded on the road traffic side of the bridge, setting fire to seven fuel tanker wagons. Two lanes partially collapsed as a result. The chairman of the Crimean Republic State Council has blamed what he called Ukrainian vandals. Meanwhile, Russian media, citing the Kremlin spokesman, says President Vladimir Putin has ordered an investigation. Ukraine reacted as well. A presidential advisor says the blast is the beginning and that everything illegal must be destroyed. The bridge was opened in 2018 with the aim of integrating Crimea into Russia's transport network. It serves as a key transport link for carrying military equipment to Russian soldiers fighting in Ukraine. Johnny Miller is our correspondent joining us from Donetsk. Johnny, so I guess the key message here is from the Ukrainian presidential advisor, says the blast is the beginning and that everything illegal must be destroyed. What are the ramifications of this main bridge linking Crimea to mainland Russia?
Well, yes, it's important to recognize the Ukrainian government has not officially claimed responsibility yet, but Ukrainian government officials are already celebrating this attack, and you quoted there a government official saying this is only the beginning. Meanwhile, Russia said they are going to carry out an investigation, but already Russian officials are pointing the blame at Ukraine. One member of the Russian parliament says that this is not only a challenge by Ukraine, it is a declaration of war, I quote, a war without rules. So what does that mean? we can expect a massive response now from Russia. For months now, we've been expecting Russia to escalate, to start attacking other targets within Ukraine. From the beginning of this conflict, they focused on military targets, headquarters, barracks, weapon supplies, and many Western analysts have been confused as to why Russia hasn't launched strikes against civil infrastructure. Of course, when the Americans invaded Iraq, of course, they started hitting Baghdad from the very start. Many are confused why Russia hasn't done this yet. We've been expecting a kind of red line, if you want, to be crossed by Ukraine over recent months, perhaps when Ukraine attacked Belgrade or Rostov in the Russian Federation, or when they started attacking Crimea. But this attack on the Crimean bridge, it looks like it'll be a major point in this war, as we expect Russia to strike back with a huge amount of force. They may well hit power stations, bridges, civil infrastructure. We've been expecting that for weeks now, especially as Russia has mobilized over 300,000 men who are slowly coming into the Donbass region. So this attack on this bridge, all the fingers are being pointed at Ukraine. This attack on this bridge looks to be a major moment in this conflict.
Indeed, indeed. Johnny, thank you very much indeed for that. Johnny Miller there, our correspondent, joining us live from Donetsk. Now, homeless charities in the EU say they are at a breaking point due to a spike in the number of people seeking support. A conference in Brussels hears the crisis is set to worsen this winter due to growing inflation and interest rates. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Leading experts at this European Economic and Social Committee conference in Brussels on Friday said homelessness in the EU has increased by 70% in the past decade. A conservative estimate suggests there are 700,000 homeless people across the 27-country bloc.
We see now with the energy poverty and the increasing vulnerability that are happening around Europe that we are very, very concerned that those figures will also be increasing further. And that's why we believe that it's really important that we'll join forces.
Young adults in precarious jobs are in one of the highest risk categories. If you have a mortgage, then repayments are going up due to interest rate hikes. If a landlord has a mortgage, they are passing on extra charges to tenants. Homeless people don't vote. So is there an incentive for politicians to take action?
If in such a short time so much can be done for Ukrainian refugees, and also if so much could be done for homeless people during the corona pandemic, I think we can do the same in the future. It's just a question of political will.
Those who have experienced being homeless say it's a very difficult situation to escape from.
Everybody thinks you are a little bit shady or something like that, and nobody trusts you, and you don't trust anybody. When people start to trust me, I start to doing better things for me, for myself.
Critics say the current economic crisis and resulting social misery could have been avoided if EU leaders had prevented the war in Ukraine through diplomacy. It has been suggested by some political commentators one way the EU could ease its growing homelessness crisis would be for Western nations to adopt a foreign policy that is less aggressive, which would avoid further displacement of millions of more people. Jerome Hughes at the European Economic and Social Committee, Brussels.
The Indian Minister of Petroleum and Natural Gas says New Delhi will buy oil from any country it deems necessary. Harish Singh Puri says the Indian government has a duty to provide its citizens with energy and will get it from wherever it has to. He says India has not been told by anyone to stop purchasing oil from Russia. The Indian official says energy security requires that governments buy from wherever necessary. His comments come as the West is cutting down on its energy purchases from Russia. Western states are doing so in line with their sanctions and restrictions on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Joining us is Manawar Zaman, our correspondent from New Delhi. So Manawar, a display of sovereignty from India clearly saying, listen, we buy our energy from wherever we want to buy our energy from, not from who Washington wants us to buy our energy from.
Well, absolutely. Every sovereign country wants to make sure that their interest is safeguarded first. It's about natural procedure. India has reaffirmed time and again that it will take public interest, the country's interests into consideration first before deciding on the foreign policies and many other issues related to economy. And it is a very good step, and it's a positive step in the right direction that India has taken in many in the past as well. Now, Russia, which is already facing sanctions from Western countries, has worked a mechanism to deal with imports and rest of the economic activities. And I'm sure India is preparing such footprints, India is preparing such kind of program or any sort of way to deal with the sanctions and continue Iranian oil imports. Because as we know, India and Iran has been a major energy partner since decades. And Indian refiners are also, they are customized in a way that it becomes easy for them to use Iranian crude oil imports. And in recent years, they also worked up mechanisms to use a barter system and the currency swap system. But the sanctions have literally been hostile lately. Now, India is also looming at a large unemployment crisis and economic that this Russian-Ukraine war has prompted. It's beyond the imagination that Indians are struggling with the day-to-day daily essentials. The food prices are on the top of the roof. At the same time, the oil prices are shooting, sometimes fluctuating. And there has been many protests about the rising prices of the essential commodities, especially the crude oil, which keeps on fluctuating. And unemployment is also a greatest worry the country is facing right now. So naturally, oil import is something which India is a major partner in terms of the countries that imports and exports oil. And India depends on the oil imports, and economies are largely dependent on imports. So yes, of course, it adds to the economic activity of the country, and it will do everything possible to safeguard the interest of its population. And here we are talking about a country with 1.4 billion people, and the energy consumption is enormous. It's humongous. And of course, the country will do everything possible to make sure that the oil import flow is completely smooth without any hindrance. And I've heard it from sources, India is also looking at ways to continue oil imports from Iran. Maybe it's in a procedure of drawing those footprints the way it has done with Russia in dodging the Western sanctions. I'm sure it will work out with the mechanism and continue oil imports from Iran. Back to you.
Manawar, thank you very much indeed for that. Manawar Zaman there, our correspondent, joining us live from New Delhi. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Statistics and studies show the number of cases of violence with firearms in the United States has increased in recent years, especially since 2020. As gun violence ramped up during the coronavirus pandemic in America, cities also saw homicide rates rise. And that trend continued in 2021 in many of the nation's most populous cities. The American people are the most armed citizens in the world, and this estimate from the 2021 National Firearms Survey shows that about two-thirds of American adults own a gun. In this regard, we have taken a close look at some of world press and news agencies to shed more light on this matter. Please stay with us. Over the weekend, at least 9 people were killed and 48 wounded in multiple shootings in different parts of the United States. The U.S. Gun Violence Archive says more than 30,000 people have died from gun violence in the United States so far this year. According to CGTN website, in Norfolk, Virginia, police say 2 people were killed and 5 others injured by gunfire at a party on Sunday, 4th of September. On the same day, at least 6 people were injured in a shooting incident in downtown Charleston, South Carolina. In Maryland, a 15-year-old teenage boy was killed and 3 other people injured after 2 gunmen opened fire on Saturday, 3rd of September, inside a convenience store. From Friday, 2nd of September, to Sunday, 4th of September, the city of Chicago in Illinois reported a number of shootings that left 6 people dead and 34 others injured. Last year was the deadliest for the city of Chicago in 25 years, with nearly 800 homicides recorded. The News Times Daily explains more about the story, saying, "Gun and violence have become ubiquitous words. It is appalling. America is known from abroad to have a culture in which the procurement and ownership of guns lead to the pervasive killing of students, worshippers, and innocent bystanders, causing premature death in thousands of people. In the face of this prevalence, gun violence is declared a public health crisis, an epidemic of evil, with hand weapons being the instruments. Every tragic and sorrowful shooting prompts governmental action followed by disagreements and inaction. Citizens are acting instead. Some activists want an office of gun prevention. Some communities are establishing community intervention programs, starting with young people who are on both ends of the gun, as drivers and victims of violence. U.S. Congress passed the first major gun safety legislation in years. However, even the National Rifle Association, the NRA, stated, "It does little to address violent crime." Sure, access to fewer guns by fewer people means fewer deaths, but gun violence is not going away. With so many guns already in circulation, hundreds of gun laws written and not passed by Congress, and the pressure of the gun lobby make enforcement of the new act questionable about reducing gun incidents. If using hand weapons is of epidemic proportions, efforts to mitigate it are essential. It means getting to the root of why crimes are committed in the first place. Those committing shootings that have been determined to be impulsive and immature youths and adults with problem histories, all who found ease in purchasing guns. Warning signs were there. Bullying and being bullied, depression, adverse childhood experiences, stress at home, and an interest in violence and hatred. If these markers are identified, individuals can be assessed and managed as early as possible. Researchers about gun violence prevention can use data to identify potential threatening people. The Minnesota Reformer writes, In a country where there are more firearms than people, mass shooting incidents have become increasingly frequent, and gun violence in general is on the rise. More Americans died from gun violence in 2020, the most recent year for which there is data, than any other year on record, and gun violence was the number one cause of death for children in 2020. In the past year, the country has grappled with an onslaught of mass shooting incidents, from a 15-year-old boy shooting and killing four students and wounding seven others at Oxford High School in southeast Michigan, a gunman killing seven people and wounding dozens more during a 4th of July celebration in Highland Park, Illinois, another gunman killing 19 children and two teachers in Uvalde, Texas, the deadliest mass shooting in 2022, and a gunman, an avowed white supremacist, shooting and killing 10 people at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. Amidst this terror, experts are grappling with why this is happening. The answer is that it is layered. There's the fact that guns are ubiquitous in the United States. In a country of about 330 million people, gun owners possess about 393.3 million weapons, and gun ownership soared during the coronavirus pandemic. The current gun violence crisis comes at a time when gun ownership soared during the pandemic and the number of white nationalist groups jumped by 55% during the Donald Trump presidency. Experts say there are a lot of guns and a lot of anger, much of which is fueled by white supremacy that spreads like a wildfire because of social media in the country right now. Following the shooting incident at Oxford High School, U.S. Democratic lawmakers called on their Republican colleagues to act on legislation meant to curb gun violence, including Senate bills 550, 553, and House bills 5066 and 5069, which would require gun owners to store firearms that could be accessed by minors and children in a locked box or other secure location. Other bills, including bipartisan and bicameral legislation, Senate bills 678, 679, and House bills 5371 and 5372, would prohibit individuals convicted of domestic violence misdemeanor from owning a gun or ammunition until 8 years after they have paid any fines and completed their jail term or probation terms. None of these bills have received a hearing. CNN's website elaborates more on the issue, saying, "Gun violence is rampant in the United States. According to Gun Violence Archive, there have been at least 456 mass shooting incidents in 2022, leaving 30,237 people dead. That's an average of more than 1.8 mass shootings every day so far." The 2018 Small Arms Survey found that there were approximately 393 million firearms in civilian hands in the country, or 120.5 firearms per 100 people. That number is much higher now, given the soaring increase in gun sales in the past few years. U.S. President Joe Biden in July said that a flood of guns was turning American communities into killing fields and vowed to reinstate a ban on assault rifles. The remarks came in a White House ceremony to mark new gun control legislation that he signed on 25th of June. President Biden said, "This has taken too long, with too much of a trail of bloodshed and carnage. The past many years, across our schools, places of worship, workplaces, stores, music festivals, nightclubs, and so many other everyday places, they have turned into killing fields." A group of parents and family members who lost their loved ones in the Uvalde school shooting incident joined gun safety advocates outside the Texas governor's mansion in Austin, Texas, recently, pleading for Governor Greg Abbott to move to raise the minimum age to purchase an assault rifle, AR-15 style rifles. With schools across Texas having already welcomed students back into the classroom, gun safety advocates are calling for the governor to hold a special legislative session so state lawmakers can vote on whether to raise the minimum age for purchasing AR-15 style rifles from 18 to 21 years old. The Texas governor, Greg Abbott, has repeatedly said he would not do so. Abbott has claimed that mental health is at the core of America's gun violence epidemic, not firearms themselves. One of those parents say mental health is part of the problem, but that refusing to acknowledge that guns play a part as well is ridiculous.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on NATO to launch preventive strikes on Russian soil, drawing a furious response from Moscow. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called the remarks an appeal to start yet another world war with unpredictable and monstrous consequences. Russian President Vladimir Putin had previously warned the West that Russia would use all available means to respond to threats against its territorial integrity. Moscow says now the need for its operation in Ukraine is highlighted even more. Well, as Putin has accused Western countries of engaging in nuclear blackmail and trying to destroy Russia, a recent report claims that U.S. special forces are on the ground in Ukraine as part of a broad clandestine operation, which includes the CIA. Joining us on Spotlight, we have International Action Center Sarah Flounders joining us from New York. And activist and commentator Don DeBar joining us from Austin, New York as well.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Flounders. According to a recent report, U.S. Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Ukraine, citing unnamed U.S. intelligence and military officials. The report says this presence is part of a broad clandestine operation that includes the CIA. What is the purpose of this presence, in your opinion?
Well, this broad CIA Special Forces operation has been going on for years, since the 2014 coup that was orchestrated by the U.S. to overthrow the elected government in Ukraine, and it has been nonstop. U.S. military contractors, trainers, CIA forces, special forces, NATO forces from other countries have been intensely involved in propping up the Ukrainian government, militarizing it start to finish, and shipping in an enormous quantity of weapons and then trainers and handling those weapons. This has been a big, big operation, and it's all pointed at how to break Russia's relations with the EU through sanctions and military means, and really to utilize Ukrainian forces to do the fighting and dying and the complete destruction of their economy, and also to bring down, it's really brought down the economies of Europe.
Don DeBar, the report says U.S. clandestine operations inside Ukraine are, quote, now far more extensive than they were early in the war when U.S. intelligence officials were fearful that Russia would steamroll over the Ukrainian army. Give us your thoughts on this report initially, and is this just what the U.S. and NATO wanted all along, for this conflict to be a prolonged one and to see it dragged out for as long as possible in hopes that it weakens Russia?
Well, certainly the goal of U.S. foreign policy is to not just weaken Russia, but to topple the government and break it into the nation state into several constituent pieces that they can control so they can loot the natural resources and more or less exploit the human resources as deeply as possible. And if you look around the world for other examples, you can see that that's pretty deep. Resources on the ground were there long before the coup in 2014. Those are the forces that engineered the coup in 2014. Victoria Nuland is, on video bragging shortly after the coup d'etat that they had spent previously $5 billion and essentially preparing for the coup. They had built infrastructure, communications, radio stations, television stations, printing presses, all things that were used to propagandize essentially an ideology that led to the division of the country, exacerbating the existing divisions that you could see on an election map, for example, the 2010 election, to the point where it became violent and the nation state was broken up. The goal of the U.S. in Ukraine has been to position military hardware there, to create chaos where they couldn't dominate it, to terrorize the Russian people with actual Nazis. I mean, the collective memory of Russia is of Nazis is of 30 million Russians and other Soviets being killed in World War II. And that if chaos reigns there, fine. If there's an extended war, fine, because the military-industrial complex makes money. It's also, this whole conflict has been weaponized against Europe. Certainly Germany will not rise and the EU will not rise as against the people who, the construct that belongs to the people who run the United States, since they can't even get gasoline to power their factories. It's a win-win-win for the elite in the United States, and it's a lose for everybody else. We may end up with a nuclear war, and we can talk about that some over the course of this program if you'd like. We may end up with an extended brushfire war like we used to see in Asia back in the 60s. No matter what it is, the elite here thinks that they're going to win. If we end up with a nuclear war, however, that will be shown to be a delusion, and it will be one, unfortunately, that we will share the consequences of if we don't stop it.
Sarah Flanders, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, as we mentioned in the intro, has called on NATO to launch preventive strikes on Russian soil. Those comments drew a furious response from the Kremlin spokesman, who called the remarks an appeal to start yet another world war with unpredictable and monstrous consequences. What is your perspective on the recent comments from the Ukrainian president?
Well, first of all, Ukraine has absolutely no independence. They are just a proxy puppet force for U.S. war plans. And the quotes and statements that they make, really are vetted through the U.S. So it's a new level of threats, an extremely dangerous level of threats. But it is this political force in the Ukraine is a U.S. creation. and it shows a dangerous escalation of one threat after another. Could this lead to wider war? It certainly could. And creating that anxiety and fear is part of U.S. strategy, whether it is the destruction of Nord Stream 1 and 2 or constantly moving more and more forces, higher range of equipment, or in the political statements. So I really see this as a new threat coming from U.S. And they're not doing so well in this war. And so how do they keep upping the ante, dragging it out, dragging more forces into it, and further, as I said, complete destruction of Ukraine and also of Europe itself. So it's dangerous, and it does show that the U.S. Is more determined than ever to drag this war out and escalate it.
Don DeBar, Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned the West that Moscow would use all available means to respond to threats against its territorial integrity. How do you read into these warnings, and how seriously should they be taken?
Well, they should be taken very seriously. But what's happening, in essence, is a statement for the world to understand of Russia's strategic military policy. On the one hand, the United States is conducting, it's not just a proxy war, as we're learning. There have been U.S. military assets on the ground since 2014 and probably earlier. There was a document signed by Obama enabling military assets to be placed there back when he was president, and this was in 2014. So we're actually at war with Russia. Russia knows it, okay? The Pentagon and Langley know it. The only people who don't know it really are the American people. The statement by President Putin was, in essence, this is the pair of conditions under which we would contemplate the use of or use nuclear weapons. Number one, if they're used against us, clear enough, that's the mutually assured destruction statement. Number two, if our state is under existential threat, in other words, if someone is going to take down the Russian government, we're going to use all the weapons that we have at our disposal to prevent that. That's why we have a military. Now, the United States claims that that's why it has a military. It has a budget as large as the next nine countries combined, including Russia, which is three nations down the list from the U.S. And yet, the United States doctrine requires the placement of 800 military bases around the world, at Russia's borders, at China's borders, constant drilling and wargaming at the borders of these countries. And so for Russia to say, if you're going to take our government down, as you say you are doing while you are moving military assets around our borders, we're telling you we're not going to allow it to happen. And there's one last point to keep in mind here. Even if Russia allowed what happened in 1991, which is sort of the dream of the people in Langley right now, to happen again. In other words, even if by sanctions and military activity draining the morale of the country and all of that, they were able to effect instability in the government where the government might fall, the Russian government cannot fall this time. The Russian people will not sit for it because they remember the 1990s and they will not go back there. If they force the existing government down in Russia, the Russian people will demand someone more militant and more militaristic to fight a war with the United States. This is a very dangerous game that's being played here.
Sarah Founders, Russia has time and again said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were in fact parties to the conflict. The question is, will this support result in this conflict spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger?
Well, that is certainly the effort, the attempt by the U.S. Wider war, endless military budget, endless military profits in a decaying, dying system that is unable to provide for people's needs right here in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world. So they have every interest in widening the war, in engaging other countries among the states of the former Soviet Union, in threatening China in new and really dangerous ways, and all while continuing the wars in Syria. They still have troops in Iraq, threats on Iran, threats against Cuba, Venezuela. We could just look around the world. The U.S. plan is for wider war, new threats, and creating everywhere they can real instability, anywhere that economically or militarily they can upend a country. They're all for doing it. And it's a very dangerous policy that creates more and more instability around the world. And yet at the same time, I would say the entire global South has refused to accept the sanctions and is more and more trading and exchanging and connecting with each other in ways that are unprecedented, historically unprecedented. So it is more isolating for the U.S. and its NATO partners than at any time in history before this. It used to be they called the shots. That's how, and they're used to functioning in that way. They would declare a country sanctioned. They would declare that they were taking down a country, and the world stood by. That's not happening in this war, and that is a new development. Now, how the U.S. responds with more threats, more efforts to widen the war, but the cohesion among countries that are refusing to accept this is also growing apace much faster than we have ever seen it. And it's a needed response because every one of these countries now knows they got to cooperate with each other or they will be taken apart.
Mr. DeBar, Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces have retaken some areas in the southern Kherson region. Now, Kherson is one of the areas which was recently declared by Vladimir Putin to be part of Russia. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has promised that these areas recaptured by Kiev will eventually return to Russia. Looking at these developments on the ground, what does this mean overall for the conflict, in your opinion?
People treat war generally, and this war at the moment, as if it were a football contest or some other thing where it's an emotional tug of war that goes back and forth. The United States conducts war lately, say since 1990. You shock and awe, you bomb a place into oblivion, and then as the troops and everybody else escape from the inferno, you pick them off from helicopters and, you know, with mortars and everything else, and you level the place. And then you try to occupy it for 10, 20, 30 years, as in Afghanistan, Iraq, et cetera. And so the end of the football game comes rather quickly, 30 days, 60 days, whatever. In other words, everything's obliterated within a short period of time, and that is mission accomplished. Russia, number one, first of all, isn't conducting this war halfway around the world with people that are strangers that they're trying to dominate. These are their brothers. They were part of the same nation state on and off for the last 500 years. The families live on both sides of those borders in the same way the families live on the borders between New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania and Connecticut. And so the idea of going in and obliterating Ukraine, which Russia could do with one squadron of planes in an hour and a half, it doesn't occur to them. And further than that, they understand that when this war or whatever this ends up being is over, they're still going to be neighbors. They're still going to have to do business together. They still are going to have families on both sides of the border and all of these things. And so their approach has been something different, and their mission is something different. Their mission was to remove a military threat by the West on their border and to remove this influence that was stoked by the United States over a period from World War II, really, up until and through the coup and to the present, of this Nazi ideology. That looks here like their plan to conquer Ukraine is failing and that they're being reversed. And it's being portrayed that way in the propaganda. But in fact, what's happening is Russia is on game. They're playing chess. They're not playing football. It's a long game. And if you look at a map of the 2010 presidential election in Ukraine and look at a map of the referendum last week or 2 weeks ago in the four republics, you'll see that actually support for joining Russia covers a piece of real estate about three times that's been voted on so far. And these little pieces of territory that are being ceded back and forth to avoid major conflicts in populated areas are all full of people that would rather be in Russia than Ukraine. And over time, that's what's going to happen. The question is, how much is the United States going to stoke destruction before that happens? And the real question is, how long are we going to allow this to go on? Because they're spending our money that we need for food, gasoline, medical care, and education at a higher rate than they've spent it on anything in the last 50 years. And we're sitting around fighting over Roe v. Wade and rainbow flags and
sure.
other things that are important but not nearly as consequential as World War III is going to turn out to be if we let that happen.
Sarah Flounders, in light of the recent developments on the ground, how do you view the prospects for an end to this war?
I really think that the U.S. will again and again block every effort of negotiations. However, as we learned from Afghanistan, wars end. And they end by, and they're hard fought. It's at a great loss of life. But where the U.S. can no longer continue with the forces that it has created to continue the war. Now, the Ukrainian military is coming apart. Its losses are enormous. Its losses of equipment is rather spectacular. Even greater than its losses of equipment in war is the amount of equipment that simply gets resold. I mean, the amount of war profiteering that goes on in Ukraine, huge shipments literally disappear within a mile over the border into Ukraine. There's a huge reselling of equipment and a vast amount of corruption. So the Ukrainian military will come apart and is coming apart. The loss of life is horrendous. But I don't think this war can continue, especially into the winter, regardless of how long the U.S. wants it to continue and is willing to send the trainers. That doesn't mean they will have the army that they hope to have. And they have, the U.S. does keep pumping in, as these recent articles show, special forces, CIA agents, contractors, but they're not the bulk of the army. You need Ukrainian forces for that, and you need equipment and the training to use the equipment, and that is what is coming apart. On the other hand, Russia is more determined than ever before. These areas are now part of Russia, and that changes even the military doctrines. So I don't think this war can continue in Ukraine. Doesn't mean the U.S. will stop at other efforts or that they won't quickly move on to China, Iran, or some part of the former Soviet republics, because they have other plans. But in the Ukraine, I think it will reach its limit in the inability of the Ukrainian military to respond. And we can see that happening now.
And Adan Dabar, one last question for you. We have about a minute left. Why did NATO continue to exist following the collapse of the Soviet Union and at the end of the Cold War? Why? What is the purpose, basically, of NATO today as we speak?
Well, for exactly what you're seeing. The purpose of NATO is to conquer Russia. It was always that. And what you're going to see happen instead, as they try to induce instability inside Russia and some of the other allies of Russia, what they're actually doing is inducing instability in Europe. And if they don't solve this problem in Ukraine within the next couple of weeks, you may well see revolutions in Germany, France, Italy, and a number of other places, Czech Republic for sure, as a consequence of this adventure. And so, you know, they may think that they are working on Plan A, but Plan B may rear its head and provide a surprise for everyone. October or maybe later surprise.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests from New York, Ms. Sarah Flounders from the International Action Center, and also thanks to Don DeBar, activist and commentator, joining us from Austin, New York, and also special thanks to your viewers for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decree.
His decree, though, we learn...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Ya khaliqa kull shay'in wa waritha.
So dear listeners, we are talking about the result
of our disciplines that are carried out in order to enhance, promote, and strengthen, and really power up our ubudiya, our servitude, our obedience, and our